Thank you. May it please this honorable court, my name is Jeremy Flax, and I represent the employee, Na Williams. This case comes to you from the full commission. It is a case of statutory interpretation and presents pure questions of law. Therefore, it's a de novo review without deference to the decision under review. Briefly, the facts, Ms. Williams.
I don't think we need to hear the facts, but let me ask you this question. Do we need to define, since it's not defined by the statute, what the term compromise settlement is?
I think that a full reading of 65.2-309 conveys the intent of the legislature to require the employer to seek the approval of the commission and the employee before entering into any kind of resolution of its lien. And I think that... Well, I think they do say it, not as clearly as probably you or I would have liked, but they do say it by the language contained in some subsections A, B, C, and D. And I do think, Your Honor, the focus is rightly on 65.2-309.
Well, settlement, I mean, I think we all, as lawyers, we all understand what settlements are all about. There's a negotiation, some give and take. And what occurred here was an arbitration. There were no concessions made. The arbitrator basically decided what the outcome was going to be. So I guess the threshold question for me at least, is does arbitration constitute a settlement?
Well, I'll first throw a monkey wrench in that question by noting that on page 42 of the appendix, the employer's counsel admitted they settled the part of the lien to which they're entitled to. So he used the word settlement as describing what happened in this particular case.
We're not bound by that. I mean, it's a legal determination, it seems to me.
Fair enough.
I mean, there was arbitration here, correct?
There was arbitration based on the information we were provided after the fact. There was a secret arbitration done without any knowledge. I would ask this question. If somehow an arbitration is not encompassed by the phrase verdict or settlement, does that mean that the employee, Ms. Williams, could arbitrate her claim and not pay any sum of money to the comp carrier under its lien? So if you reverse the question you asked, you come up with a result that clearly isn't logical and isn't what the legislature intended. The employee has to protect the workers' comp lien. But if we're going to parse these words, settlement and verdict, to the extent that the employer would like us to, then we can turn that on its head and we could go to a mediation or arbitration, settle the tort claim, and by the terms of this statute, we wouldn't owe a single penny of the workers' comp lien back to the comp care. Clearly, this isn't what the legislature had in mind.
To get past that, what right of your client was implicated here by this resolution, by this arbitration?
Well, she has the right to control the litigation in the absence of the approval by her and the commission to a lawsuit filed by the employer. Controlling the litigation means a lot. It means that we get the right to negotiate the lien. It means we get the right, the employee gets the right to vet the lien. It is not uncommon for workers' comp liens to include.
But here the lien is not on your client's behalf, it's a lien on behalf of the employer by statute.
And the employer either files suit with the approval of the employee and the commission, or allows the employee to file suit and protect the lien. The lien is not a fixed sum, though, Your Honor.
The employee has been made whole by the employer here, but through the workers' comp provisions. They're entitled by statute, if they can, to recover some or all of their claim from a third party.
Well, only with the permission of the commission or the employee, and that never happened here, and there's a good reason for that, because we were prejudiced, Your Honor. I think that the question you may be asking is how were we prejudiced? Well, first of all, the employee didn't get the benefit of the pro rata reduction, which the record clearly shows that this law firm would have turned over to the claimant. So she lost $1,400 off the top right there. Second of all, she didn't get the right and still hasn't had the right to examine the so-called workers' comp lien to determine exactly what the components of this lien were. Nor did she have the right to negotiate the lien, which is a common practice. Many times, as I was saying, the workers' comp carrier includes in its lien sums of money which are not compensable by statute, such as fees for job placement, vocational rehab, sometimes defense attorney's fees, defense medical exams. None of those by law are reimbursable. Many times we discover that those amounts are thrown into the lien. When we're properly performing our job of representing our client as well as protecting the employer, we vet that lien and we review that carefully.
One question I had is, and this is not teed up in the briefs, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is the answer to this, I mean, under established case law, the threshold is low for who is an indispensable party to a proceeding, okay? And why would it be any different for arbitration and therefore to require in this scenario the employer to notify the claimant or the insurance carrier to notify the claimant, and then the claimant can make whatever decision whether to show up and participate in this or not show up. And then is that part of the solution to this puzzle?
Yes, but I think it's not notify, it's seek the approval. And there is a difference.
And well, notify is the beginning of it anyway.
Yes.
But that's part of the problem is often what you see in litigation is, well, I was an indispensable party, I was never brought into it, we need to set it aside and start over. But that's not the relief requested.
Well, I mean, you've hit an important point. The employer did something it wasn't authorized to do and left the employee out. And we were an indispensable, necessary party to that proceeding by statute. Remember, the employee has the common law right to file a tort action. The employer has absolutely no common law right to do anything under these circumstances. Their rights are contained only with what's written in 65.2-309. And if you read between subsection A and subsection C, subsection C says no compromise settlement, true, uses the word settlement, shall be made by the employer in the exercise of such right of subrogation. That leads right back up to subsection A. So subsection A and subsection C are tied together. Where else under the statutory scheme is the right of the employer to act ex parte and initiate a piecemeal litigation to recover exactly the amount of its lien? It's not found anywhere in the code, in the compact. And remember, this act is really for the benefit of the employee. And that's a bedrock principle. These statutes are designed to benefit the employee. Yes, we do protect the employer's lien, and with notice to the employer can file a suit to recover the total amount of the tort action. But there's no authority anywhere for the kind of piecemeal, ex parte, secret race to the arbitration hearing type of proceeding that happened in this case. There's just no statutory authority for it. And in fact, you know, when the employee is put in this position, you can look at this case. This was a low dollar value case. I think everybody recognizes that. But change the facts a little bit. Let's say the employee suffered severe injuries, and let's say the attorney spent $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 on a product case or a very complicated personal injury case. These numbers change dramatically. Instead of what happened to Ms. Williams being out $1,400 plus $60 with the costs, you'd end up with an employee, Your Honor, that would be out thousands and thousands of dollars. In fact, in our brief, both VTLA and the claimant note that with low limits – If you allow this decision to stand, the employer, here it was Companion, the employer will race to an arbitration proceeding and literally eat up the entire liability settlement.
And it's your time. You're starting to get into your rebuttal.
Yes. All right. I'm going to hold off.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Karth-Marzik, and I represent the appellees, Capital Hospice, and Companion Property and Casualty Insurance Company, which has since been acquired by Instar.
Miss, can I follow up on something Judge McCullough asked? Why didn't y'all give notice to the employee or the employee's attorney that you were going to arbitration?
So, on October 13th, 2011, Ms. Williams had her accident. On October 27th, 2011, she filed Mr. Flax filed a letter of representation with Victorian Nationwide. Then employee filed her first claim for benefits without counsel. So when this went to web file, Companion did not have any notification of counsel. Then on March 23rd, 2012, arbitration was filed. It wasn't until 5 months after that employee filed her second claim for benefits, which included a letter for representation. So for 5 months, Companion had no idea that Mr. Flax was even involved in the case because he did not give notification.
Is the law firm your employee's agent? I mean, it's an agent principal relationship, isn't it?
I'm not sure I understand what you're asking.
The relationship between the employer and the insurance company.
But they informed Victorian Nationwide, and we're here representing Companion. Companion's the workers' compensation carrier. So Companion was not informed. They only informed Victorian Nationwide.
But you knew who she was. Was there any attempt to notify her, irrespective of notifying counsel?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that ultimately notification here is really not even the point of the matter, because what we have here is an arbitration and a reimbursement between one insurance company to another.
And the interests of the employee and the employer are largely congruent, but not entirely congruent. And we have through the amicus brief and through the appellant's brief different scenarios where the interests don't exactly coincide. And so that's what got me to thinking, but if the employee or the claimant has a seat at the table, then that can get sorted out. And if they don't, then you potentially might have problems. Whether you have problems in this case or not, I don't know.
Well, we left the third party to our claim open here. This was simply a reimbursement of the $4,000 exactly that Victoria Nationwide owed Companion. Ms. Williams was not prejudiced and was not prevented from bringing her third party tort claim, which was evidenced by the fact that she ultimately settled her case for $10,000. So she wasn't prejudiced and her rights were not implicated because she was able to bring her claim. Under 309, the employer has the right of subrogation of stepping into her shoes and bringing that claim, but that's not what Companion did here. Companion simply resolved it's through arbitration. And
what is the statutory authority? I mean, because clearly the statute envisions where the employer could launch it with a subrogation as opposed to this sort of discrete subset. What is the authority? If all this is governed by statute, where's the statutory authority? I mean, it may make perfect sense to be able to do what your client did, but what's the statutory authority for this discrete kind of thing?
Your Honor, I would just represent to the court, and it is not in the record, but this is just standard industry practice of one insurance company reimbursing another one. If not, we would just have a floodgate of litigation between two insurance companies with simply $500 at stake. There was a little more than that here, but still not much. So the statutory authority comes in with the right of subrogation, but the action here did not even really implicate 309A because Ms. Williams' tort claim remained fully intact. And so when you get down to 309C, the full commission found that that contemplated only the exercise of the employer's right of subrogation by prosecution of the tort case because that relates directly back up to A. because A is, and you can, this statute itself says, no compromise settlement shall be made by the employer in the exercise of such right of subrogation. Well, the subrogation would be companion stepping into the shoes of Ms. Williams, which would be what would happen in A, and that is not what happened here.
What is your answer to the question that Judge Humphreys put to other counsel that is arbitration a compromise settlement?
Arbitration is not a compromise settlement.
Why not? Do we just quote you in the opinion? How do we do that?
Because Ms. Williams' third-party tort claim remained intact. She was still able to bring her claim. She could have taken it all the way up to trial if she had wanted to. She chose to settle it. And for if this had been a compromise settlement, then her ability to do so would not have been there.
Well, do I understand correctly, then, that you're suggesting we interpret 309C as follows? Basically, it doesn't apply in the first instance because the right of subrogation wasn't in play here at all. And secondly, 309C also doesn't apply because this wasn't a compromise settlement in any event. Is that the thrust of your argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Here we have this. Here was companion being reimbursed $4,000, the money that it was owed. Ms. Williams, as I have said, still had her tort claim. She was able to bring that to trial and ultimately settled her case for $10,000.
Well, okay. Let me follow up on the earlier question then. Why is arbitration not a compromise settlement? I mean, I assume the two insurance companies here decided to submit to arbitration. You generally can't be forced to arbitrate unless there's a contractual agreement to do so.
Well, the arbitration is not a compromise. It was a binding decision between those two insurance companies with concern of that $4,000 only. But there was no negotiation, no concession, no giving up of the claimant's rights.
But it's not, I mean, instead of doing the negotiation, you just say, well, we'll just pick somebody, an arbitrator, as opposed to litigating the thing. And whatever the arbitrator says will go between the two of us. So it's not your classic settlement of just the lawyers trading emails and letters and faxes, but it's just another way at getting at a settlement between the parties because they didn't have to go into this arbitration to begin with.
Well, Your Honor, no, they didn't have to go into the arbitration, but companion also did not release liability here. If ultimately Ms. Williams has further injuries and more claims that exceed her $10,000, we're on the hook for 35.4% up to the $10,000 and then beyond that. So we did not release liability here. Companion is still involved in this. So it wasn't a compromise settlement. It was simply a reimbursement of the $4,000 owed because Ms. Williams remained with her claim intact. Victoria Nationwide still had their claim with Mrs. Williams, and Companion is also still involved.
So any heartburn with a finding that going forward in this type of scenario, the claimant or the attorney has to be given notice?
Would I agree with what you're saying? Well, that's just not what the statute says. Like, Mr. Flex.
No, and this is case law driven. I mean, if there's an interested party. Now, I understand there's arbitration, and that's different than litigation. If this is litigation, we have a million cases that say someone in her shoes has, you know, is a indispensable party. This is arbitration, but I don't see why the answer would be any different.
Mrs. Williams did not let Companion know, though. So, and this was simply a claim between the two insurance companies.
But you can see, can't you, that at some level that impacts on her ability to recover down the road?
It didn't, though. Not in this.
I'm not saying on these facts. I'm just saying there are. I mean, they posit all these different scenarios where that could be the case.
Well, and if Mrs. Williams, or in a hypothetical situation where it was more money, more at stake, then they could have taken this to trial, and under the collateral source rule, they could have put everything on the board, and the $4,000 that Companion had been reimbursed would have still been considered because it would have gone up on the board with all the other medical expenses. So, in the event that we have a situation where it appears that there could be a higher number more at stake, then trial is always an option. The settlement didn't have to occur here. Ms. Williams chose that route.
Right. Okay.
So really the real party affected here was claimant's counsel, not even Mrs. Williams. But the act is not designed or created to provide extra compensation for work not done to a claimant's attorney. Here, Companion initiated the arbitration, used its own manpower, hired Praxis, and resolved its $4,000 lien with Victoria Nationwide. Mr. Flax had not even let Companion know at this time that he was involved, and now he wants $1,400 for services that he did not render. Appellees are aware and accept our obligations under 311 and 313 to play a pro rata reduction of the employer's lien when a benefit has been conferred. Here there was no benefit conferred. And I would direct Your Honor's attention to two cases, Circuit City v. Bauer and Wood v. Cottle Height, that demonstrate where there was a benefit conferred. And compared to the case we have here, they are very different. In those cases, the employee instituted the action, paid all the expenses, and negotiated a settlement. The employer was not involved, but was conferred a benefit because the lien was reimbursed. In those situations, the court found the employer must pay the pro rata share of reasonable expenses and attorney's fees because they benefited from the employee's action. The purpose of 311 and 313 and 309 as well is to prevent the employer from placing the entirety of the litigation expenses onto the employee. That is not what happened here. Additionally, as we've touched on earlier, the full commission was correct in holding that Companion did not prejudice the claimant's ability to resolve her tort claim, as evidenced by the fact that she did do so for $10,000. She had approximately $6,000 in medical bills, and she had hired an attorney and settled her case for $10,000. In rebuttal, we would invite Mr. Flax to point to the prejudice in such a settlement because the record does not reflect any such prejudice other than what Mr. Flax has been stating. Additionally, claimant could have prosecuted her claim and gambled on the receipt of the verdict. She chose not to do so. That was her choice. By doing so, that in and of itself also does not speak to prejudice. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Flax, what
yes,
did you
Judge.
Do to deserve this $1,400?
Your Honor, in this case, we were not given the opportunity to, quote, perform acts that would culminate in a check to the employer because the employer raced to the arbitration proceeding in an ex parte secret manner a mere 5 months after the accident without any notice. And I do want to correct one other misnomer or mistake in the record. Before the decision, a few days before the arbitration decision was issued, we had web filed our letter of rep. Several weeks before the check was cut to Companion by Victoria, our letter of rep had been web filed. So it's not accurate to state, if it matters at all, which I don't think it really does, it's not accurate to state there wasn't notice to Companion of Ms. Williams' representation by counsel. But the question asked earlier was appropriate. What about notice to Ms. Williams? There was
I don't think you're answering Judge Haley's question, which is...
The prejudice?
What was done to this $1,400?
Well, we performed everything that a personal injury attorney would perform, but we weren't given the opportunity to pay the lien out because the comp carrier raced and beat us to the, in this case, they chose in our proceeding. So we didn't get a chance to earn the money.
Suppose you represent somebody in a personal injury case, and halfway through the case, they decide, I don't want you as my attorney anymore. And you got an attorney's lien, right?
Yes.
If they fire you. But that lien is premised upon the fact you did something. What did you do here to justify the $1,400?
That question, I submit to you, is the wrong question. Because everybody in this room
knows... It's the question I'm asking you, sir.
Correct. But everybody in the room knows we didn't get a chance to do anything. The comp carrier raced to the hearing.
Is that correct?
I guess not, because we don't know what they did at the arbitration hearing.
What did this arbitration resolution prevent you from doing that you otherwise could have done?
Well, first of all, it's not permissible. But if you want to get to the practical effects of what happened, the claim was essentially eviscerated. When we went to negotiate a settlement,
how was it eviscerated?
We were told by Victoria that all the specials had been paid, which, by the way, wasn't true because several of the medical bills weren't paid, but we didn't have a chance to vet that because we weren't part of the arbitration proceeding. Only 66% of the wage loss was paid.
Why didn't you tell defense counsel, well, fine, you're right, but the jury is going to hear how much they were? You could do that. Collateral source rule will not permit you from letting a judge or jury put that evidence in of all of it.
No, nobody's saying we couldn't try the case. But what happened between hearing of the arbitration proceeding and making a decision to litigate definitely affected our ability to negotiate. There are many decisions that go into whether you try a case or not, but the fact that we recovered $10,000 shouldn't be assumed that that was a great recovery. This whole case was colored by the fact that the comp carrier, Companion, rushed in and arbitrated and withdrew most of the specials from the equation before we could get to negotiate Victoria.
No, I'm not understanding that last statement because I understand your point about how it might affect your negotiation position, but the bottom line is if you choose the remedy of a court proceeding, the specials are admissible, the verdict will be whatever the verdict is, but you're not precluded from offering the evidence in any way, shape, or form, as far as I can tell. So, to the extent it may influence the degree to which somebody might want to engage in pretrial settlement negotiations is purely speculative, it seems to me. And in terms of what actual right has been impacted here, I still can't see any. That's my problem. Maybe you can help me with that.
For 35 years, I've handled personal injury claims. The manner and method of handling these claims is to negotiate with a liability carrier based on the medical specials, the wage loss, and the pain and suffering, without having a piece of it removed, in this case unlawfully, without any authority, by the comp carrier who entered into an arbitration proceeding with no authority. So the entire negotiation process was turned on its head. Furthermore, we don't know what amounts were paid and for what by the comp carrier, by Victoria to the comp carrier, because again, we didn't get a chance to vet that lien. There are many circumstances. That's the reason why the code has enacted the statutory scheme that it has. It's to protect the employee from this very kind of mischief. Yes, we could try every case where the comp carrier wants to arbitrate if the court's going to allow them to do so. We could end up having to try every one of them because we can't negotiate in the traditional manner because the claim's already been eviscerated. That's true. Yes, we can always go to court.
When you're negotiating, though, is not the defendant going to know that this has been covered by workman's comp? Isn't it?
I don't know what they'll know. In this case, we still never got the full facts of what happened at this ART proceeding. So I don't know what they'll know. I assume that there will be communication if we learn of these what I continue to call unlawful arbitration hearings. We'll get some facts about what amounts were paid, as we did from Victoria when we went to negotiate the claim. But, I want to go back to something
And your time's expired, and you're about 2 minutes into your expired time.
Oh.
So I want you to fully answer the questions you've gotten, but then we need to conclude.
Okay. Really, the question to be asked here is not where does the code prohibit the proceeding that Companion initiated. It's where does it authorize it? Nowhere. Their rights are creatures of statute. It is not authorized anywhere. It's not incumbent upon me to explain where in the code it's prohibited. It's incumbent upon them to tell you where in the code it's permissible. It is not permitted anywhere in the code. The full commission likewise never explained the statutory basis for the decision allowing this arbitration proceeding.
Thank you very much for
Thank
your
you,
argument.
Your Honor.
We'll come down and greet counsel.